Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's special guest is a legendary musician and singer-songwriter whose illustrious five-decade career began as a backup musician for Joey D and the Starlighters, but very quickly evolved into the creation of one of the greatest rock and roll bands of all time, the Rascals. His pioneering musicianship on the keys of the Hammond B3 electric organ, together with his rich, powerful R&B vocals, gave the Rascals their signature sound, which was pure magic, in a long string of hits, including Good Lovin'. I've Been Lonely Too Long. Groovin',
groovin' on a Sunday afternoon, really couldn't get away too soon.
How Can I Be Sure? A Girl Like You. A Beautiful Morning.
It's a beautiful morning. I think I'll go outside for a while and just smile. Just taking some clean, fresh air for me.
Don't stay inside.
If the weather's fine and you got the time.
And People Gotta Be Free. Our guest, together with his bandmates Dino Danelli, Eddie Brigati, and Gene Cornish, better known as the Rascals, are widely considered to be the very first real rock and roll band, and they were without question the best blue-eyed soul group to emerge in the 60s. Their song Good Lovin', originally recorded by the Olympics, is listed by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as one of the top 500 songs that shaped rock and roll. And Rolling Stone included it on their list of the greatest songs of all time. And the song Groovin' was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 1999. Since the Rascals broke up in 1972, our guest has had a hugely successful solo career with 7 albums, including his self-titled album, Felix Cavalieri, Destiny, Treasure, Castles in the Air, Dreams in Motion, Nudge It Up a Notch, which got a Grammy nomination, and Midnight Flyer. He continues to perform across the country and around the world for sellout crowds with his band, Felix Cavalieri's Rascals. And last year, he released a highly compelling, deeply personal, and very moving book entitled Memoir of a Rascal, which is truly one of the most poignant and spiritually uplifting memoirs I've ever read. The list of accolades this man has received is staggering. As a member of the Rascals, he's been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Hit Parade Hall of Fame, and the Vocal Group Hall of Fame. And as an individual, he's also been inducted into the Musicians Hall of Fame, the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and the Hammond Organ Hall of Fame. And of equal importance, in 2015, he received the Harry Chapin Humanitarian Award from the World Hunger Association in recognition of his well-known efforts to make the world better, kinder, and more generous. I'm delighted and deeply honored to welcome the legendary Felix Cavalieri to our show. Felix, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for that wonderful introduction. That really felt good, let me tell you.
You deserve it. Now, Felix, I know that you spent the first 8 years of your music education as a child deeply immersed in classical music. You are a classically trained pianist, but at some point you must have turned on the radio and heard the sounds of rock and roll and soul music. Who were the artists who made you fall in love with that music?
Well, I had a really good fortune of growing up near New York City, where Alan Freed brought his, they called it Moondog in the beginning, but it became rock and roll on WINS in New York City. So when I turned on the radio for the first time and heard Little Richard, Ray Charles, Jerry Lee Lewis, Fats Domino, playing the same instrument that I was learning, I just could not believe the difference. I mean, I said, well, I think I found something. Maybe I should learn this.
Well, I love that you mentioned Ray Charles, because if I'm not mistaken, Felix, you played with the band on the Joan Rivers show when Ray Charles was a guest. So he must have heard you playing during the commercial breaks. Did you get to talk to him?
I did. And that was a real treat, you know, and I'll never forget it, because I was playing with the band and, you know, the house band there, and I was looking over and staring at him, and I sang every note of those breaks right to him. And when I hit a good one, he went like this. And I said, yes, I've arrived. That was a treat and a half, which I'll never forget.
You wrote about being bullied as a kid and having a hard time being comfortable in social situations. Did that experience of being on the outside looking in, did that experience have an impact on your musical choices, especially as a songwriter?
I don't know that it had an impact on musical choices. I think that basically had an impact on how you approach life. When I was in school, you know, most of my friends were mostly athletes. They were a lot bigger than I was. And so I didn't get much attention until I started playing music. And so then I noticed, wow, like this is a good way to have people, especially the opposite gender, notice you. So, I mean, a whole lot of reasons going into what makes you want to be on a stage.
Now, you endured the worst tragedy and trauma that any child can experience. You lost your mom, Laura, on your 13th birthday. She was only 45, and that plunged you into a profound state of confusion about the existence of a God who could take such a good, religiously devout woman away in the prime of her life. Do you think you found a way to channel your grief into your music?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what happened to me. And I noticed that, you know, some of the Beatles had the same circumstance. And I think a lot of people who have a loss like that, they have to find A, answers, and B, they have to find strength, and they have to find discipline and understanding if they're going to maintain their sanity. And I think that really drove me to a lot of the good things that have happened to me in my life.
Before we move on to talk about your career, I think it's very important to mention the spiritual transformation you experienced after becoming very close with a man you refer to as Swamiji. You adopted a very healthy lifestyle. You acquired a holistic and karmic perspective to the meaning and the purpose of life, and you began doing meditation. Can you tell us, Felix, what did Swamiji teach you that helped you understand the reason for your mom's tragic passing?
Well, I think that, you know, like when you reach out and ask someone a question as metaphysical as that, or as unknown as that, you have to really have a faith and a belief in that person's kind of strength and knowledge. And basically, it took me a little while because I had to kind of, you have to prove yourself to a teacher. You don't just jump on the ship and take off from the harbor. After a certain amount of time, he kept educating me with different tenets and especially with different things to read. And it became a very involved subject. But, you know, like, for example, the Buddhists, they pay attention to that word, you know, death, because death is part of everyone's life. Whereas a lot of people, they just kind of ignore it and they just let it be like in the side pocket, you know. It's there. If you want to learn about it, you can. And as I say, depending on who you're learning from, you can achieve some sort of understanding. I did.
Well, Felix, I want you to know how profound and meaningful it is that you immortalized your mom, not only through your music, especially when you perform with symphony orchestras, but through your wonderful book. You made us all get to know her, and I really love that.
Well, that's great. You know, I'm glad that you were able to, you know, kind of feel that, because, you know, I have a sister, and she's in the same boat as far as this is concerned. It's a difficult thing, but it happens to a lot of us. And as you say, there's a reason and a meaning for everything. I think if you can rise above and kind of like try to understand, it can help you in life. But I mean, seriously, you mentioned earlier in the talking that we had here about the music lessons. I wouldn't have had music lessons if it wasn't for her. So I mean, I owe her that.
Well, you've paid her back, believe me. So let's talk about your career. Is it true that Soupy Sales came up with the name The Rascals?
Well, you know, that's the way I remember it. You know, when we did our 2013 Once Upon a Dream tour, we were down there on Broadway with our show with the original guys, the original members. We did press conferences. And I noticed at the press conferences that, like, for example, how did you get the name? Everyone had a different answer. So I said to myself, wait a second, you know, I better look into this, because I'm not so sure that, you know, in America, General Custer won or lost that battle. It might be whoever was last there. So I decided to write that book. But that's exactly the reason that I started that.
Well, I'm glad you did. I was fascinated to learn from your book that early on, you were told that legendary record producer Phil Spector wanted to work with the Rascals, but you said no. Why?
Well, basically, he did. He came to see us. So we started off in Long Island, basically at this place called The Barge, which was in the Hamptons, which is, you know, usually the summer place for the hoi polloi and all the big record people and all the big actresses. And it was a place where I kind of really felt we were going to get discovered. Well, the word got out and Phil Spector came to see us. Now, you know, notwithstanding his personal life, I idolized his work. I mean, his work has stood the test of time. I mean, every Christmas, that is like the number one album that most people play, and everybody's copied it ever since, you know? So he came out and he really wanted to produce us. But the reason that I said no is that I wanted to produce ourselves. I wanted to be the producer. I felt that, first of all, I felt a desire to learn how to produce. I heard an album, a record, right in the 60s, which was called Money by Barrett Strong. It was produced by Berry Gordy. And I said, what is producing? What is it? Oh, I see what it is. It's putting the ingredients together of a record. I said, well, I think I could do that, you know. I mean, I wanted to be a producer as well as an artist, as well as everything else. Why not? So when we had to say no to Phil, it was difficult. But see, the thing is that when you are under the tutelage of Phil Spector, even McCartney, you are a Phil Spector production. You're not a Felix Cavalieri Rascal production. And I didn't want that identity loss.
I think that was really a very brilliant instinct you had, because you had a distinct idea of the sound you wanted to create: a Hammond organ, a funky guitarist, a dynamic drummer, and great singing.
You got it, man.
It's really interesting to me that even though you didn't want Phil Spector to produce your records, you wrote a song, What Is the Reason, as a tribute to him, didn't you?
Well, yeah, I basically, you know, emulated a lot of, I mean, I remember one day I was doing a song we had on another album called I Believe, and he actually walked in, you know, and it was just like, oh my God. You know, if you want to learn to produce, you know, the best thing to do seriously is not necessarily take a course, but just listen to some of these geniuses that produce. He is one of those. Quincy Jones. Just you want to learn to produce? Put on Quincy Jones records. I mean, you want to learn the right way? My goodness. If you go back in time and say, well, Phil, I loved you, man. I really did.
I want to take you back to those early days at Atlantic Records. There you were in the same recording studio where Ray Charles, Otis Redding, John Coltrane, The Drifters, Benny King, so many others made their classic recordings. You wrote that making a record is like taking off your clothes in front of the world and then saying, how do I look? What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm not sure what I meant by that, but yeah, because, you know, when you're on a stage, you have the visual to kind of like offset the fact that, you know, oh, gee, maybe I made a wrong note, or, you know, maybe I didn't look so good. Let me see. We can fix that with the lights or something. But when you're in the studio, especially in the vocal booth, that's just you. Now, of course, technology has changed so much that, you know, we can pretty much make anybody sing correctly these days. You know, it's just like our what do you call word processors, you know. Do you have to spell? Not really. I just turn on the, you know, the corrector. But we didn't have those in those days. You either were a good singer or you didn't sing. I enjoyed so much the Atlantic experience. I mean, that I hope came through in the book as well. Atlantic was a label, and it still is a label, that really, really, really produced wonderful music. It was an amazing, amazing experience. They allowed me, they allowed us to make music. And what else can I say but thank you?
Oh, and the world thanks them for that. Can you remember what it felt like to hear yourself on the radio for the first time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Sure. Yeah, we were walking on in New York City, and we were told that one of the major radio stations, ABC at that time, Cousin Brucey, who's still on ABC radio in New York City, was going to play our song, you know, it was called I Ain't Gonna Eat Out My Heart Anymore. And we were told, we were kind of given a heads up, hey, man, tune in between, what was it, 6 and 6:30. Well, yeah, on this little transistor radio, when we heard it, oh, my God, yeah. I mean, it was just like the same thing. But, you know, this is interesting. It's still the same. When you're on an elevator or you're in a store or something and you hear your song up there, you go like, blink, wow, how cool is that? It's still very cool to hear yourself through speakers.
I love that you still have that enthusiasm. You haven't lost that sense of wonderment and having to pinch yourself after all these years. I hope you never lose that.
Oh no, I won't lose that. That's really a joy. Yeah, it is. I mean, is it, what do they say? Joy de vivre. You know what I mean? Like I say, if you love what you do and you're lucky enough to do it and be able to do it, cherish it. Yeah.
I want to ask you now about Felix Cavalieri, the songwriter. You started out playing the piano as a young child, but when did you realize that you were going to be not only a musician, but also a songwriter?
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing, because, you know, if you have, and I believe most people do have some sort of creative ability, what you do is when you sit down at your, you know, instrument, in this case, you know, piano, you experiment, you know, you try different things, you know, and the first instance was that it was when I tried to change Bach, you know, and the teacher said, that's not how he wanted it. Don't do that. So I knew that, you know, there was a little bit kind of a rebellious nature in my playing someone else's music. Maybe I should write some of my own. So I started, you know, like learning how to escape into that place of creativity. And I think that that is a gift that I not only appreciate, but I want to make sure I never lose.
Well, your vision for the Rascals was to have the sound based around the organ instead of being guitar driven. So how did that impact your songwriting?
Well, I think basically when you come from the musical beginning of the keyboards, you're relying on beautiful kind of harmonies. You're relying on rhythm all at once. They're all there. The rhythm's there. The harmonies are there, you know. And so basically you learn that, oh, violins, stingers, they're kind of in the same place. You know what I'm saying? So if we don't have violins, but we got great singers, we can do those pads and we can do those. So the organ, it was really the only instrument that I knew of before synthesizers, of course, that could achieve all of those things with one instrument. You could do your bass, you can do your rhythm, you can do your leads, you can do your choruses, your pads, so to speak. And if you have a microphone, you can also sing while you're doing that. There was no other instrument that I'd ever seen that could do that.
You wrote that you were heavily influenced in your songwriting by the Beatles. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I think everyone was in those days. I mean, seriously, I had an experience which I mentioned in the book about hearing them before they came to the United States. I heard them in Europe. I was with Joey D at the time, and they were opening for Joey D, believe it or not, and no one knew them yet in the U.S. And I noticed that when they did their original songs, it was unique. And I think the whole world realized how unique it was and still is. So that inspired me to kind of like see what I could do with that, you know, because I understood that it was an identity as well as a song. It was an identity that you could tell it was them, you know. And the good thing, the amazing thing about that particular group is that there was three songwriters, prolific songwriters. You know, I understand that George Harrison's songs are some of the most requested of all the Beatles songs. That's pretty amazing for a third string, you know, writer, as in this case, you know, John, Paul, and George. So I think, you know, the time that we came up in was the time when singer-songwriters really came to the fore.
Well, that's for sure. Your song Groovin' spent 5 weeks at number one, and the record company didn't even want to release it. I was shocked when I read that.
Well, you know, no, it's very interesting when people make music and they bring it to, you know, the so-called superiors or the people who make the decisions. They're not always right. As a matter of fact, there's history. There should be books written about how many people were rejected. You know, Beatles were rejected by Decca Records. I can name three or four stories that I know of. Matter of fact, some of the record execs that I know put those things in their office when they, like Luther Vandross, for example. Luther, I tried to bring him to Epic before he signed there, and the person who was in charge rejected him. I said, "Are you crazy? It's one of the best singers I ever heard in my life." No one has a crystal ball when it comes to that, and a lot of times, and in that case, that was a kind of a decision. Well, why are you changing your genre? Why are you not using a drum? You're a rock and roll band or an R&B band. Where's the drum? Well, the drum was a conga. And I think that's what turned them to say, wait a second, are you guys a Latin group? Yes, we are today. Exactly.
Well, while we're talking about songs that the record company didn't want to release, I have to mention your classic song, People Gotta Be Free, which has always been a worldwide anthem for social justice and equality. In fact, the original manuscript of that song is in the Library of Congress. Correct. Is that the song you're most proud of, Felix?
In the long run, that probably will be the case, yes. Because, you know, I'm still very cosmically conscious of our world and our world problems. And, you know, unfortunately, we really haven't even solved them in the United States of America, never mind the world, you know. Because my teacher, my guru, told me when I would go to him and complain about some of the world events, he said, you know, I gave you a broom and I told you to clean out your closet. You want to clean out the whole house? Clean your closet first. Great advice.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, it is.
Are you able to put into words what is it that makes a hit song?
Not really. No, I have to say, you know, that's if you could put it into words, you know, you could put maybe put it into a computer, and I don't think that's what happens. The audience really decides in the long run what makes a hit song. Now, of course, you know, they're marketing tricks, endeavors. Like for example, if I put enough money in to have the airplay so that, you know, you hear it 5,000 times a day, chances are you it might become a hit, but that's not the kind of hits that I call hits. I had a neighbor here in Tennessee who wrote a song and he put it on an album. He was a Christian artist, you know, and he called me up and he took me over to his house. He said, "Fields, would you do me a favor? Our daughters used to play together. They were like same age." He said, "Would you listen to this song?" And I my wife wants me to put it on an album, and I don't think it fits. It was called Butterfly Kisses. Well, I don't know if you've ever heard that, but it's about your daughter kissing you with their eyelashes. I started crying. He put it out. It became a 5 million seller. You know what I'm saying? The audience really has some sort of an instinct for whatever it is that attracts them. And I wish I could pin that down, you know, but you just have to keep doing it until it happens. And if it doesn't happen, keep doing it.
But when you're recording a song, can you tell if it's going to be a hit?
No, you really can't. You know, at Atlantic, we used to have a wonderful relationship because in the old days, before they became Warners and had a big building, they were just a little office, you know, and in the side of the office was the studio, and in that side of the office were the secretaries, and then you had the execs. Well, when a song would start to record in the studio, first people would hear it would be the secretaries. So when they started dancing, then the next thing you know, the execs would come in. When you have all three of them, you got a hit.
I want to ask you now about Felix the Performer. You opened for James Brown at Madison Square Garden, and from that experience, you began adding more showmanship to your concert performances. Do you think that the additional showmanship had any impact on your musicianship?
Yeah, probably, sure. Yeah, 'cause you know, I mean, if you've ever witnessed James Brown in person at a concert, it was a phenomenon. It was absolutely amazing. And you know, we our managers knew one another, you know. So I guess somebody dropped out of the show at the Madison Square Garden, the old Madison Square Garden. So they asked us to open up for James Brown. Now that's almost impossible. But still, we were welcomed, but when he performed, it was unique. The only people that I've really seen in my life that come close to that, seriously, Prince and Michael Jackson, they're about the closest thing I've ever seen. They took a lot, you know, like people took a lot from his performance. But of course, it influences the way you look, the way you act, the way you play, the way you create your set, you know, for them to hear, because there's something to be said about pleasing the audience. You know, if you please the audience, that's really what you're there for. You know, I mean, that's that we're not, I have this conversation with artists all the time. You're not there to please yourself. You're there, you know, the audience is who's paying to see you, and they want to be entertained. Oh, well, let's entertain them.
When Tommy James was on our show, he talked about the exploitation in the music business where artists were not properly compensated for their work. And you wrote in your book about people like Sam Moore of Sam and Dave, Jackie Wilson, Wilson Pickett, and even Ray Charles, who were not always properly paid. So, Felix, you were only 21 years old when you signed on with Sid Bernstein and Walter Hyman. Did they sufficiently protect your business interests to keep you from getting ripped off?
I think so. You know, I mean, it's usually like even your department stores, they write off 10%, you know, for pilferage, you know, that I think it's just a given in our industry. But you see, you mentioned Tommy, you know, and Tommy's a friend, and I respect the heck out of him. And I'll tell you why, because yes, if you've read his book and if you know his career, he had a very, 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 very tough time with the powers that controlled him. But you know what, man? I never heard him complain. I never heard him go, "Oh man, you know what? I got ripped off." Oh, well, because what I heard him say was, here it is, 50, 55 years later, I'm still known. I still can make money. I'm still earning because now those people are no longer, no complaint. I really like that.
I love it too. And I love the fact that that story that he lived through is going to be a big movie.
That's what I understand. That would be quite a film. But it's a good thing those people are not around now because it might never see the screen.
For sure. Well, I've interviewed a lot of music stars on the show, and I've come to the conclusion that very few great musicians are also good business people, don't you think?
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. There are exceptions in the modern world. You know, I think a lot of the country entertainers, because, you know, I live in Nashville, they really, really are good at it. Garth Brooks, of course, was a marketing major. Alan Jackson, everything he touches turns to gold. Mick Jagger and those people, they did a very good job. But most of us, we're right brain, left brain, you know, heavy, you know, and so we have to rely on people. And, you know, I'm very fortunate to have met a manager later in life who really has helped me tremendously. So here's our adage here is, if he was only born when we had the Rascals, but he wasn't born yet.
Well, I'm glad you've got a good team around you now. I've dealt with some of them, and I agree, they're terrific.
Good.
Now, you wrote quite a heartbreaking chapter in your book, Felix, about the reasons why the Rascals broke up, the personal animosity, the insecurities, the lawsuits, and especially the immaturity, the poor judgment, the lack of a common vision for the group, and of course, the egos of some people. Looking back, was there anything you could have done differently to prevent the breakup?
Probably. You know, I mean, they're probably, it's difficult when it's like, for example, when you become a parent, you know, and most people are untrained for that experience. They just kind of do what their families did. But if you take the time to read how to be a parent, you could probably take the time to be how to become a leader of the band. One of the mistakes I made I kind of tell all of them, I was a communist. We were all one and one and for all. I'm not sure that's the best way to go. I don't think that's the way to do it. Sometimes you need leaders. You know what I'm saying? I mean communist in the sense of we shared everything. We were all for one, one for all, not in the political way, God forbid. You know, but what I think is that, you know, like you rely on the management and the lawyers to a degree and your advisors to, you know, kind of be the adult in the room. And what happens a lot of times is that the group becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, and the managers are afraid to tell them, hey, you know what, you didn't sound so good tonight. Oh, you didn't look so good tonight. Yeah, you gotta be told the truth. And then you can govern. If you just, you know, like kowtow to everybody, that probably could have been amended. But again, I was 1 year older than everybody. I wasn't really like the elder statesman or anything. But I think that, you know, if cooler heads could have prevailed, we would still be around.
Well, your very dear friend, Tommy Calagna, said something that I thought was very harsh to you. He said that the Rascals were the dumbest rock and roll band in the world.
Well, he wouldn't know. He wouldn't know. Yeah, well, because you see, a lot of the business decisions that were made were foolish. Really foolish. You know, I mean, I don't know if I gave instances of that. I really tried, you know, when I wrote the book, not to go too much into the darkness and, you know, the lawsuits and the things like that. I don't know if you've read that Crosby, Stills, and Nash book, but that's a pretty rough one.
Yeah.
You know, I really think people are that interested in that, unless they're lawyers trying to figure out a case or something. We had from the conception of the band till, well, I won't say till the breakup, but at least a good 3 years into it, 3-4 years into it, we had a wonderful experience, something that I will never forget as long as I live. When it kind of started falling apart, sorry to say, that's an embarrassment to me. There was absolutely no reason for it, you know, and there still is no reason for it.
That comes through loud and clear in the book. And, you know, when your friend tells you, well, they were the dumbest rock and roll band in the world, I think what he was saying was that you had such a clear vision. You were so dedicated. You were such a businessman about what you wanted the group to do. you'd worked so hard and you were frustrated by this lack of common vision, this common passion. You know, it's okay to be a communist, I get, if everybody agrees.
Well, I say that as a joke, but don't forget now, I had a teacher, I had a guru during those years, and believe me, the common sense factor is really one of the major things that I learned from him, because most of the things that these teachers teach you, you already know, you know, you just kind of ignore them, you know. Basically, it was an experiment, but you know, we're not alone. I mean, so many groups and partnerships and marriages, they split up for the silliest reasons. Fortunately, there was no really bad reason. You know, a lot of times there are bad reasons. There could be embezzlements or, you know, cheating on somebody's wife or something like that. We had nothing like that. We had a great bunch of guys. We had, I thought, a pretty darn good organization. Not perfect, you know, but I think perfect, I'm going to have to wait a while till I get to the next level of existence for perfect.
Well, you achieved something that very, very few groups do. So that's pretty close to perfection.
Yeah, we had a good time.
Your songs have been covered by everyone, from Aretha Franklin and Olivia Newton-John to The Fifth Dimension and Mark Stein. You've had songs that were in TV commercials and on dozens of movie soundtracks. It must be so gratifying to see that your music has such a timeless quality about it.
Yeah, that's a good feeling, especially when you, as I say, if you come from a classical background. I still got a few hundred years to go to be remembered to be like those people.
It'll happen. You've had quite an amazing solo career since the Rascals broke up. When you started performing on your own, was it difficult for you to go from the back of the band to being front and center on stage?
Well, it was difficult in that it required a bit of a learning curve. You know, because I had kind of started like that. And then, you know, I was very, very happy to be, you know, the musician, taking care of the music with the band. I had no problem with that. But then when I was put back in the front because of the fact that there was no group anymore, I had to retrain myself. Yeah. Difficult. It was more a question of experience. You know, like I just had this conversation with a young artist down here in Nashville who is working, you know, in kind of like the clubs downtown. And I said, you know, you're really way ahead of the game, because most artists today, they work in front of a computer. They don't know how to deal with human beings. You got them right next to you in a club. You have to learn how to cope, you know, with the good ones and the bad ones and the ones that love you and the ones that are kind of bored, you know. All of that is part of being in front of people.
I want to tell our viewers that you can learn more about Felix Cavalieri by his music and see his concert schedule by going to his official website, FelixCavalieriMusic.com. Well, Felix, I have only one more question for you. Look at the life you've lived. Just listen to this for a minute. When you were playing with Joey and the Starlighters on tour in Europe, the Beatles opened for you one night. And then years later, you got to play in Ringo Starr's band. You appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show 3 times and on dozens of other TV shows. Jimi Hendrix opened for you at your Central Park concert. You've played with legends like Billy Joel, Laura Nyro, Randy Bachman, Alice Cooper, Willie Nelson, Billy Preston, and so many more. You've been inducted into 5 Halls of Fame. Your music is still enormously popular all around the world, even in Japan, where your Peaceful World album is one of the best-selling albums of all time. People who don't even speak English can sing your songs perfectly. And many musicians like Billy Joel and Paul Schaefer have said publicly that you were their most important musical influence. So Felix, my question is this. Do you get, I mean, deep down inside, do you get how incredibly talented and beloved you are?
That's a tough one, man. No, I attribute this to a connection. You know, I believe very strongly that there's a connection, that if you plug into that connection, you get this greatness. So, you know, I hear a lot of athletes and people say, oh, all glory goes to God. Well, I really believe that. I don't take it personally. In other words, I feel like, you know, I was very lucky to be able to connect. And once you connect, anything can happen.
Well, Felix, I want to tell you something. When you made your acceptance speech at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you said, and I'm quoting you here, "We wanted our music to be more than pop. We wanted it to reach across racial and social barriers to help all of us understand each other a little better. That's what our music is all about." Well, Felix, I want to thank you for achieving that objective all your life, not just through your music, but by being the human being that you are. It's been an immense honor having this opportunity to interview you. Thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
Well, thank you so much for the kind words. And you're right. It's one of the best interviews I've ever had, sir. I
Oh.
appreciate you. Absolutely.
Well, you made my day. Thank you.
And you did mine. Thank you. And I'm so happy we were able to finally get together. And I hope we can break bread sometime.
Absolutely. And you're welcome back on our show anytime.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Our guest has been rock and roll superstar Felix Cavalieri. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to our producer, Steve Silver, my wonderful managers, Rick and Robin Marcelli in Hollywood, and my entire team at the XPTV One Network in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.